made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Just a moment here. We're going to be talking about the environment with James Spath from Yale University. Before we do that, we do need to make a moment here to remind you that our fiscal year here at WILL ends tomorrow. It is the last day, and as you have been hearing over the last couple of weeks, we're working on raising the money that we will spend on programming for next year. We are still a little short of our fundraising goal for the year. We hope that we can get just as close as possible here before midnight tomorrow. Jay Pierce, our station manager, is here in the studio with me.
I've lost 8 pounds in the last few days worrying about this. The idea is to raise the money that helps to bring you programs like Focus 580, a unique program. If you travel around the country and listen to other public radio stations, I think you'll find that this is something that sticks out as an example of relevant local programming that you don't just get everywhere. And people tell us that all the time when they travel. They miss WILL unless they can listen online. Some who have moved away told us that they really miss the station, having it in their community. And those who move into the community tell us, boy, what a pleasant surprise this is to find such a great offering in this community. Now, it needs your support. We have an immediate goal for today to make things simple, and that is to go as far as we can toward meeting a challenge which has been set forth by Case and Elaine Sprinkle and Don and Carolyn Mullally. They will add $1,500 to our total as soon as the dollars in the bank reach $800,000. Okay, so call 217-244-9455 and make a credit card contribution or go online to WILL.UIUC.edu and pledge there. You can help meet the challenge and push us closer to the goal that we need to be at by the end of the day tomorrow. We are $44,000 right now away from $800,000, okay? So $44,000 just as soon as we can. And if that sounds like an overwhelming amount, David, this morning when I checked the fax machine, and that's where we get some of the the numbers, the contribution numbers come in that are called in, we get the reports. There was a $600 contribution, $250. So you see people are making some significant contributions as they renew their membership, put in additional gifts at the end of the year, joined for the first time. And that really does make that number go up. And especially in these last 2 days, that's what tends to happen. A lot of people wait till the very end to get things done. And that's fine, just as long as you don't forget. So 217-244-9455. Your contribution, whether it be $40 for the first time, $40 if that's what you can fit in your budget, if it's a $500 contribution, it will go a long way toward helping ensure that we're able to afford to bring you this program, the afternoon magazine, AM 580 News. We've internally reallocated over the past several years to deal with tax-based support erosion to the point where we don't have a bench left. And that's why you hear some of us on the air so much these days. Tom Rogers will be filling in on agriculture tomorrow while Dave Dickey's attending a conference. And you'll hear Denise Perry doing a number of programs. I'm filling in for Dan Simeone now, and we'll be probably doing All Things Considered tomorrow and the next day. We're doing what we can internally to deal with the cuts from the state, federal, and university sources. And now what we're doing is we're asking you, if this is a service that you value, you need to know that we have a greater reliance than ever on listener support. 2 more days to go to reach our listener support goal for this year. After tomorrow, we're starting the new fiscal year, and that's it. That's the money we'll have to work with. So if you've been meaning to do it, if you've been thinking about doing it, call 217-244-9455 800-800-8255 or go online to WILL.UIUC.edu. Help us get to $800,000 as soon as we can, and the sprinkles and malalis will add $1,500, and that's how it works. Thanks.
All right. Well, welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the environment and the environmental movement, both here in the United States and globally. And our guest for the program is James Gustav Speth. He's dean and professor in the practice of environmental policy and sustainable development at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University, and has been involved in environmental issues both as a scientist and an activist for quite a long time. He was founder and president of the World Resources Institute. He co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he also served as advisor on environmental issues to both Presidents Carter and Clinton. In addition, he was the chief executive officer of the United Nations Development Program. He's authored a new book that summarizes the issues that confront us as far as the environment goes. It's titled Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Yale University Press and came out in the spring. Questions are certainly welcome as we make our way through this hour. They are welcome. We only ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along and getting as many people as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, if you'd like to call in with question, comment. The toll-free line is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Professor Speth, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it. Let us talk a little bit about the environmental movement and where it is today and where it has come from, because I know that you have some concerns and write about the fact that at one point, at least in this country, there we did have a fairly robust environmental movement, and yet over the last couple of decades, it has not been as strong. We haven't been making as much progress. I suppose that one can say at best it's been a plateau, and at worst that things have actually gotten worse. What's the difference between today and, say, 25 years ago?
Well, the really interesting date is to go back to 1970 for the first Earth Day. And the country was really alive then with environmental concerns. And I think it had, you know, everything to do with the fact that the problems were really in your face. The air was filthy, the water was filthy, and it was the roads were being built everywhere and through people's neighborhoods, and dams were being constructed everywhere. Ditches were being made from rivers. And people were alarmed. And today, the problems are so different because the problems are global scale. They're more subtle. They're harder to get your head around. They're not in your face. They're more technical. People don't understand them. And so it's very hard for people to relate in the way that they did to these strictly local issues of 35 years ago. And that's been a crippling blow, really, to the effort to mobilize our country to give the kind of leadership on the global scale issues that we should be giving, like climate change.
Well, that if I asked you to make a quick list of the issues, I'm sure that would be one, and that would be one that would come to people's minds right away. And there are others, and I think that they're equally important, but they're the things that don't often come into people's minds. One of them I know is population, and some people will think about that. But we can think about other sorts of things that are connected with the burden that the population puts on the earth, the kinds of resources we consume, how much waste we generate. Water certainly is an important issue that, depending on where you live, maybe you think about it. But here in this part of the country, at least so far, we haven't had to worry about that too much. What are the things that are on your list?
Well, in my book, I talk about the Big Ten issues. It's of the global environment. They're not the strip mining and the clear cutting and the local air and water pollution that we've know and have tried to deal with in our country, but there are things. Climate change would be at the top of my list. I think it is the mother of all environmental threats. But in addition, we have burgeoning freshwater shortages around the world. Let's look at what's going on. we've consumed 90% of the, destroyed or consumed 90% of the big predator fish in the oceans. We're fishing 75% of the ocean fisheries to capacity or overfishing them. We've lost half the tropical forests. We've lost half the wetlands and mangroves around the world. We're committing species to extinction at 100 to 1,000 times the natural rate that species do go extinct. We're eroding and degrading the productivity of in the dry and arid regions of the world at an alarming rate. The climate is changing. The ice is melting. It's the range of species and the arrival of spring is the temperature of the earth have all already begun to change. Another degree warming in the oceans, we could easily commit the bulk of the corals to history because of repeated coral bleaching incidents. And then there's the spread of toxic chemicals into all over the world and into every one of us. We really don't know what they're doing. We do know that dozens are in probably every one of us and all the trees, for example, but we really don't know what the consequences of these persistent organic pollutants and mercury are in the cumulative sense. But we do know that we're getting exposures and sometimes high ones. So this is the list of issues that we face today. They are the most threatening issues that we have on the environmental front. And yet, because they are technically complicated, like climate change and ozone depletion, or remote, like the deforestation in the tropics, or long-term, they're very hard for the political system to muster the energy to respond to. And that's what we've just got to change.
Yeah.
We simply have to take control of the situation and not rely on the politicians anymore.
Well, one thing that really struck me in the book, you talked about the fact that back during the Carter administration, the president, Jimmy Carter, asked you and other people who were involved in environmental advising, this was in the late 70s, to take a look at some of the most pressing environmental issues globally and to make some projections as to where things would look at the end of the century, essentially. You did that and put it together. It was a report. It was called the Global 2000 Report to the President, and it was released in 1980. And while you didn't get everything in here right, there were a number of things that you nailed. You nailed real well. What strikes me is that in as much as there seems to be evidence to suggest that these things are issues, and just one of them is global climate change, that here now in the year 2004, we still have people arguing that we don't have enough data to say what's going on. I mean, how do you react to those people who say, well, you know, we're really not quite sure what's going on with the global climate, and it could just be, it goes up and down over time, and we could just be in one of those cycles of swing, and it could go back to the other way. And, you know, there's really no need for the kind of urgency that you and other people are saying that we should have.
Well, the truth is that we're drowning in information and very disturbing information. We're literally swamped with policy studies on what to do about these issues. We know so much. We did identify these issues as early as 25 years ago as serious threats, and we did call upon government to deal with them, and we haven't done much in that 25 years. But the amount of information and science and understanding that we have today makes what we knew back then pale by comparison. Now, yes, there are natural fluctuations in things, and there will always be uncertainties about science around the edges of some of these issues, particularly. But the truth is that from 1979, when Jimmy Carter asked the National Academy of Sciences how serious is the climate threat, up until the early Bush administration, this Bush administration, when President Bush made the same request to the National Academy of Sciences, they have come back repeatedly over and over again and said this is a very serious problem. It's incumbent upon government to take the leadership and do something about it before it's too late. And in the meanwhile, we have more or less wasted a quarter century in negotiations and discussions and bargaining and come up with a group of toothless treaties for dealing with these issues. And now we've kind of run out of time. We've reached the point where change is already happening, and we've got to move with a real sense of urgency to take some very far-reaching steps to deal with these issues, or our children are going to be the victims of our neglect. Hmm.
We have a couple of callers and would be happy to bring them into the conversation, and I should introduce again our guest, James Speth. He's dean and a professor at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. And if you're interested in reading his thoughts on this subject, look for his recent book. It's titled Red Sky at Morning, and it's published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. We have a couple callers here. Start out with we have a listener in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I really can't think of a succinct question to ask, so let me throw out just a couple things, and if you could work them into, you know, the contemporary situation, give your thoughts. Number one is, I don't know all the ins and outs because I don't get the best paper, and then even listen to WIL, we don't get all the information that's going on in the Bush group. When they try to alter things or change things with things that have already been legislated, like allowing more particulates into the air than what the legislation says, and the next thing is the thing that was done earlier where a company could trade off or purchase good points from another company which wasn't doing too much to the environment. Also wondered what happens to the people where that stuff is actually being done. You know, is this sort of, it's a very strange way to try to tackle problems, to buy good points from another company, and you just, I guess, they just continue on doing things to the environment. And I was wondering if other nations are going to pick up on these little tricks to, since satisfy the business community. And if you could say anything about that, would be helpful to me.
Sure. Well, you mentioned the Bush administration, and of course, I've never seen the environmental community in our country so concerned and so sort of mobilized to get into you know, basically our political process. But and a lot of what is going on in the administration is basically what's happening is by opening up so many long-settled issues, or at least settled issues, the administration is forcing everyone to, in effect, relitigate or refight old battles. And so we're not getting to the newer issues of the global environment where we should be putting our attention now. So that's sort of one set of problems. In terms of the trading systems that you mentioned, I think it depends on the problem. If you have a something like climate-changing gas being emitted, it really doesn't matter where it's coming from, and therefore you can have these giant, what they're called cap-and-trade systems, where different polluters can buy and sell emission rights, in effect, to each other and among each other, in order to find the cheapest solution. And that's fine with those kinds of problems. And it seems to work well with acid rain over large areas. But when you're dealing with a local issue and a local pollution, then you have to be very careful, because then, you know, basically you don't want a certain community to be adversely hit by some company that's managed to buy pollution rights, in effect, from another company far away. So it does depend on the problem, but generally speaking, these economic tools, which are being increasingly used in environmental regulation, are pretty good. You know, they help get to efficient, low-cost solutions, but you do have to be very careful. They have to be used with basically in circumstances that make sense to use them, and not others.
Let's go to our next caller. This is line one, and the caller's in Chicago.
Yes, I hope you can answer some of these questions. When you were talking about global problems, you didn't mention the effect of warfare, and I've been looking for the past 3 years and haven't seen anything yet, and I hope it's out there, discussing the impact of the heavy bombing in Afghanistan and Iraq, especially in Afghanistan, where they've been bombing those honeycombed mountains. And I know that two of the astronauts on the Columbia mission were looking at the effect of dust. So it seems to me that somewhere in the scientific community there's some concern about that. So the second question is also the effect of the depleted uranium from the weaponry, and I know that has become a very serious problem in Iraq, but I don't think Iraq is the only place where that's a problem. So if you could tell me who's been doing the research on this and what do they know so far?
Well, I think I think you're right to call attention to these issues. Their indirect effects also, for example, when you in Afghanistan, there's large areas that have been mined with landmines. And this is inhibiting the redevelopment, and it inhibits, pushes people off of some areas and concentrates in activity in other areas. So there are environmental consequences. And, one of the biggest costs of war in local communities and all these complex emergencies that the UN is involved with around the world and also on some of the bigger questions of U.S. policy, the biggest cost of war, in my judgment, is the diversion of attention and energy into those issues, so that it just preempts the space, the money, the time, the energy that we should be putting into dealing with these, what many people believe are bigger threats.
Well, thank you for your response, but you didn't answer my question directly concerning the dust.
I honestly don't know, who to refer you as the best person on the effects of warfare.
Not the effects of warfare. I really want to know the effects of bombing on the mountain terrain and also the effects of the dust on the global environment. And are there no climatologists or geologists concerned about this at all?
Well, it's not a prominent concern, I would say that. Certainly the particulate content of the atmosphere is a major concern, and it has, many different effects on things like climate change and other things. And, to the degree that we're denuding the landscape by warfare or by bombing or other means, and that's contributing to this, then there is a link there. And, the depleted uranium issue, I think, can certainly cause local problems. But quite honestly, I think these linkages are the most pronounced effect of war, the most pronounced effect by far of the war on terrorism, for example, is the eclipsing of the energy that and the time and the money and the political focus that we need to deal with these other issues,
bigger
issues that are massing on the global environmental front.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We are already at our midpoint here. Let me just again very quickly introduce our guest, James Speth. He's Dean Professor in the Practice of Environmental Policy and Sustainable Development at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale, and has been both involved in the environment as a scientist and an activist for a long time. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he was an advisor on environmental issues to both Presidents Carter and Clinton, founder of the World Resources Institute, co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council. His new book is Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment, and the Yale University Press is the publisher. We're talking here, particularly we're talking about what's going on globally, about a web of things that are interconnected, that is connections. There are important connections between loss of biodiversity and pollution and population and the global economy. And as poverty is one of the concerns, and as we have reason to believe that there's good reason to try to improve people's living standards, and that people will want to have their living standards improved. We get into questions about what happens to what sort of burden that puts on the global environment. And it seems that in the minds of some people in the developed world, you come down to questions about, well, what overall, not only what does it mean to the global economy if we really get more serious about environmental issues, but what's it going to mean to our economy? And is somewhere somebody going to have to give something up? Is it going to mean a lower standard of living, particularly in the developed world? And is it going to have some kind of negative impact on our economy and the economy of the other developed nations? And that seems to be one of the chief arguments that the Bush administration has advanced to for not supporting something like the Kyoto Accord. What is this? What does it all mean for what's the tie with the global economy? And is it possible? Is it going to be necessary for the people who are at the top, economically speaking, to actually give some things up?
Well, basically, I mean, there are two things that when you think about poverty and the need to do something about it. The first is that, you know, people deserve something a lot better than what they've got. We have half the world, of almost 3 billion people, living on less than $2 a day. And that's intolerable. So there's going to be a tremendous amount of economic growth needed, and it will come. It's already coming to China and now India, where great populations are. So basically, you have to not only encourage that, you have to support it. You have to give generously in development assistance, in my judgment, which we're not doing. And then you also, in doing this, you do address one of the most serious environmental problems, which is the pressure of huge numbers of very poor people on a depleting landscape, and that's a serious issue. And you address it indirectly because by helping developing countries deal with their development problems, that is to say, deal with their own priorities, then they become more able and more willing to help deal with some of these global-scale environmental issues. So you have kind of a compact between the North and the South, if you will, and that's where we need to go. But we're not doing that. We're a poor provider of development cooperation. We are not supporting the UN and its work in this area. We're not supporting population programs of the UN, for example. In terms of our own economy, I think in the long run, dealing with these issues can be a source of tremendous new economic growth and performance in our country. Major new industries that are geared and new technologies and new investments will be needed. We're going to have to turn over the stocks in the economy, the capital stocks. All the, you know, there's so much of the technology that we routinely deploy was designed in an era where environment didn't matter, and it really does need to be replaced. I mean, we need to get the current generation of gas guzzlers off the road and get a new generation of vehicles out there, and hopefully they'll be made by American companies. But basically, there's going to be a huge amount of economic growth. And look at it this way. When I was a little boy in 1950, it had taken all of history to grow a $7 trillion world economy by that time, by 1950. We now add $7 trillion to the world economy every 5 to 10 years. The world economy is slated to double and then double again, to quadruple in the lifetimes of today's students. And if this growth occurs with this, anything like the technologies and the techniques and the practices and the rules and requirements of the past, it's simply going to overwhelm our capacity to save the planet and push us into a totally different, a totally destroyed world, in effect. So basically, we need to make a huge transformation in the period, a very short-term period. I mean, you're going to have the size of the world economy doubling in 20 to 25 years, if you can imagine that. And it's almost certainly going to happen. And so you have to ask, what kind of growth, what technologies, what controls, the distribution of it. And we're not dealing with these issues today, but we've got to. So the solutions are really at hand, though, and this is the great tragedy that I talk about in the book. We know so much about how to deal with these problems that we're not using, and we understand them in a way that we're not utilizing. The potential to deal with these issues is there, and a infrastructure, so to speak, to deal with them is there. And so what we need is some spark to set off the citizens of our country to change things before it's too late.
We have other callers. Let's go next to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. Since you were one of the co-founders of Natural Resources Defense Council, I get their newsletter, and I read not too long ago that under the Bush administration, they have killed something like 200 buffalo in Yellowstone, and they're continuing to kill even more. And I also understand that what report I heard was that they want to get rid of all the wildlife in Yellowstone because they wanted, the Bush administration wants to drill for oil. And another report I heard is that the Bush has very quietly in the background destroyed 30 years of environmental protection work. And I just want to know what your remarks are about that.
Well, I think you put your finger on a key dimension of this, which is the fact that the administration often with the help of the Congress is re-raising a lot of old issues, trying in a way to turn the clock back on environmental protections that we thought we had in place here in the U.S. And so basically the energies of groups like the NRDC and others are being forced to deal with these issues that in many ways we were well underway to solving and getting behind us. And that's preventing us from dealing with the newer issues and indeed the more threatening global scale issues. You also mentioned energy and the oil question. This is the fundamental issue, in my judgment. The biggest environmental problem is climate change, and the biggest thing that we're doing to cause climate change is our energy policy in our country, which is simply to find as much energy wherever you can find it as possible and to burn it as quickly and as cheaply as you possibly can.
What about the animals that they're killing in Yellowstone?
Honestly, don't know too much about that.
Mm-hmm.
My work has focused more on the global scale issues. I'm afraid I know more about deforestation in the Amazon than I do about the animals in Yellowstone. But
mm-hmm.
the energy connection, which is pushing us to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and to do inappropriate things in our parks and around our forests to get to our own energy resources. That's the root of a lot of the damage, I think, not just to the global climate, but also to our national security posture in the Middle East. And basically, it takes us twice as much energy in the U.S. to produce a dollar of GDP as it does in the other industrial countries. And you flip that around, and what you can really say is that we can grow the U.S. economy by milking the energy that we currently use for more productivity, becoming more energy efficient, catching up with Europe and Japan in terms of energy efficiencies. And if we do that, we won't have to threaten our wildlife or intrude on protected areas. We can just basically use the energy that we're already getting. And if we get even better and start shifting into renewable resources, particularly wind, the combination can unhinge us from our dependence on entangling international oil supplies.
I just think that the car manufacturers certainly aren't interested in reducing the miles per gallon on their cars.
Well, I have a Toyota Prius.
Mm-hmm.
And I get about 45 miles to the gallon in my little Prius, and it's a great car. we could all be in hybrids. There's absolutely no reason that every vehicle on the road in the U.S., including SUVs, within short order couldn't be a hybrid vehicle or some other device that gets you 40-plus miles to the gallon.
Right.
In so doing, we would be doubling the fuel efficiency of our automobile fleet within a short order, and that would have enormous effect not only on our local environment, but our global climate and on our sort of dependence on Middle Eastern oil. What a huge benefit and a glorious thing for the world and our country if we could do something like that, and there's absolutely no reason we can't.
Well, I just think that if at the rate we're going, we're going to have not only an ecological collapse at the rate we're destroying our Earth, but we're going to have a financial collapse in the next 10 to 20 years if we don't change right away.
Well, you're absolutely right about the need to change right away, and the threat is very serious, and it's not just to our environment, it's also to the economy. If I were a business leader today in a major corporation, I would be seeking government action on climate, because I think the climate change issue could cause such disruption internationally that it would cause a lot of economic disturbances and turmoil. And indeed, you see people beginning to face up to this. John Brown, Lord Brown, the head of BP, had a major article in Foreign Affairs magazine this past issue in which he called for a very far-reaching goal for climate protection. And that's an oil company. So things are beginning to change, but we need to make it change a lot faster if we're going to catch up.
It seems to me, that perhaps the big challenge is that here, at least in the United States, we believe in choice, in free choice. And if one wants to have a Cadillac Escalade instead of a Prius, and you can afford it, you can have it. If when you're getting dressed to go to work in the morning and you're brushing your teeth and washing your face, you just want to turn on the tap and just let it run, you can do it. No one's going to come into your bathroom and say, oh, look, you're wasting water. You know, if you want to have a great big house that's not particularly energy efficient in the wintertime, you want it to be 75 degrees, you can do it. It seems that the issue is how do you get people to change their values to the point where they make individual choices that then the government or industry has to respond to? Because it seems that it's not going to work the other way around.
The French are introducing a wonderful tax where they are taking they're taxing gas guzzlers and taking the money and rebating it to people who buy very highly efficient vehicles. And so you do get a double whammy. If people want to be irresponsible, well, they ought to pay an extraordinarily high price for being irresponsible. But in the end, I think we also need to outlaw a lot of things. We have laws in our country now that outlaw things which are socially irresponsible and socially damaging, and there's no reason why we shouldn't apply more of that in the environmental area. We also do need desperately a value change. We need to move from being Mars to Venus, in effect, to a caring and sustaining society, to seeing ourselves as part of a natural system and not something that's outside of that natural system, and see our commitment to sustaining it and to sustaining communities of less fortunate people also in the world. And we've got to make that transition. But we also know from other experiences that we can hasten people's awareness and value change by investing in public education campaigns, as in the designated driver and drunk driving and cigarettes, and we've put considerable resources in our country to alerting people to the hazards and really making people face up to the threat that they're causing to themselves and to others with these practices. And we need that in the environment badly.
Let's talk with someone else. Urbana line 3 is next. Hello.
I agree with all the positions Mr. Spaeth has espoused, but I wonder if the message is getting out. So here's some questions in that regard. Has your new book been reviewed by a major newspaper, such in Illinois as the Chicago Tribune, or on the East Coast in the Boston Globe, or the New York Times, or on the West Coast?
Thank you for asking that question. The book has been reviewed, I would say, favorably in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker and some other places, but we would love to have a nice review in the Chicago Tribune and get some attention there. We seem to be in an era of the big book, in which one blockbuster after another, most recently Bill Clinton's, is hitting the bookstores, and I'm nowhere near that league.
Just getting a review apparently is very, very important for any book with an important message such as yours. And have you personally been interviewed, for instance, on C-SPAN or by Larry King on CNN, or on or with Bill Moyers on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
Well, I'm delighted to be having this interview, I would say in terms of the really big leagues of interviews, like Oprah and Larry King, no, I haven't been there. I would love to get on The Daily Show. I want to be interviewed by Jon Stewart on The Daily Show.
I never miss it.
that would be a hoot. But I've had some great interviews, and I must say, the people that have shown the most interest and have done the most to call these issues to attention, are the local and regional public radio stations. I've had a lot of interviews like this one, and in fact, they do succeed. That has been the principal way that the message of the book has gotten out, in addition to some of the good reviews that we have had.
One more thing. This is on Yellowstone Park. My newsletter from Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility has stated that in the viewscape around Old Faithful Geyser, the park administration has allowed some cell phone company to put up a 100-foot-tall cellular phone antenna without going through the required procedures.
Goodness.
Yep.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Those things are everywhere.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Lovington. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I've read a few articles about a group called the Copenhagen Consensus, I believe it was called.
Yes.
Which was, I believe, put together by Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote the Skeptical Environmentalist, which is a big book that I would recommend very highly. And if I remember correctly, they discussed 10 problems facing the world, not all environmental, but one of them was global warming, and they put that rather far down on their list of priorities. Do you have any comments on that? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Sure. I followed that process, I would say, casually. They looked at a range of issues, some more developmental and economical and economic, and then others environmental and ecological. Here's my take on it. To choose between some of these issues, like providing the poor with decent drinking water supplies and dealing with global climate, is really Sophie's choice. I mean, these are not choices we should have to make. There's plenty of resources to do, all of these things that are high priority issues. Now you ask, well, why didn't these people rank climate change as a high priority issue? Well, honestly, I don't know, because I think they're really out of step with the scientific community. My somewhat flip answer to that is that if you get a group of elderly economists together and ask them whether they're going to opt for environmental issues or development and economic issues, they're going to opt for the economic issues as the most important and urgent. That's, I think that's exactly what happened, in fact, but it's too simple, because I'm sure they gave it a lot more thought than that.
Yeah. Well, I think in the – and I don't know how far you want to go with the criticism of Bjorn Lomborg, but I know in your book you talk about the fact that inasmuch as he is critical of people being selective in use of scientific evidence or perhaps misusing scientific evidence to make their case, you seem to think that he's done the same thing.
Well, I think the book is, you know, is quite misleading. In a way, you know, he says things in there that, I mean, I think his estimate, or he quotes the estimate that I use in my book of the rate of species loss, which I find, you know, appalling. But he seems to think it's okay, or the world is getting better. The world is getting better in a lot of respects. I mean, look at, we have cut in half the incidence of world poverty in recent decades. Mostly that's because of China's development, but it is amazing, really. And we're on the track to, you know, we could eliminate mass poverty in the lifetimes of today's young people. So I think it's partly, and a lot of what Lomborg does is to look at the half of the glass that's full, and to look at issues that are not the ones I'm talking about. He looks at the, you know, a lot of the progress which has been made in Europe and the U.S. on the local environmental issues, and we have made progress there. But I think it's, you know, it's the overall conclusion that he comes to, which is to try to reassure people that somehow we're not in trouble. Is fundamentally and badly misleading because, I mean, truthfully, I don't know, you know, hardly any scientist who believes this, so who are familiar with these trends and who are following what's actually happening with regard to the loss of ecosystems and ecosystem services, with regard to the buildup of climate-changing gases, the loss of agricultural capacity, the spread of toxic chemicals. The world knows these are serious problems. They're out there negotiating these treaties. The problem is that they're mostly toothless treaties, and we're not getting any real traction in reversing the trends except on the depletion of the ozone layer, where we really have made great strides. I think Lomborg, in the largest sense, is misleading and dangerous in the sense of lulling people into thinking that we really don't need a major commitment to deal with these issues and that we should be focusing on other things.
All right, let's talk with someone else here on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
I was struck in your introduction of the guest by the fact that he worked in the Clinton and Carter White Houses, but not in Republican White Houses.
And they never asked me.
I wondered if that was a result of personal politics, or is that really more tell us something about the stances of those two parties regarding these issues?
Well, I'm a Democrat. I mean, but that's really not the big issue here. The big issue is that what we've seen since 1970 in our country is a steady growing apart of the two parties on the environment. If you look at the League of Conservation Voters ratings of the votes of the people in the two parties in the Congress, you'll see they started out in the 70s. We were pretty close, and basically that was a bipartisan era. We got all of our major environmental legislation passed then, and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and so on. And what we've had is this growing divide between Republicans and Democrats on the environment, and I think it's it's a tragedy. We have this huge unmet need in terms of environmental action, a big gap there, and then we have a big gap between the parties, and they're clearly related because we've got to. So I hope all the people who are basically Republicans or who would like to be Republicans will take back their party.
Well, amen to that. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll continue, and our next caller is in Champaign County. And line number two, we're going to have to be quick, though, because
okay,
we're almost out of time.
I'll try. Well, on that last point, I think I remember hearing a statistic that the top Republican leadership is all, like, unanimously zero in their rating by environmental scales. But going back to this econometric point of view, you were saying that, you know, third world is better off, but that's looking at, you know, the indicators that economists want to look at, and what we've needed for a long time, Hazel Henderson and everybody, is a different kind of economy. Another way of looking at it that includes all these ecological factors. So I don't know. I had a longer thing, but I got distracted, so I couldn't. I'll let you finish up on that point or whatever. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, no, I think it's a good point. I was the head of the UN Development Program for 6 years, and we maintained a different index other than just GDP or GDP per capita. We developed this Human Development Index, which looked at a variety of factors affecting, you know, basically the quality of life of people. The darn thing is that, you know, it's hard to find a single environmental variable that you could put into an index like that. We have measures of longevity, of health, of education, as well as purchasing power. And you can put that together in a pretty powerful index that really gives you a good sense of how well off the people are. But in terms of whether they're getting better off by destroying their resource base and depriving future generations of the prospects that they should have, that's a harder issue to put into such an index. And there have been a number of people lately who've tried to do basically environmental sustainability indicators, including people at our school at Yale. But it's darn hard.
We're going to have to stop. We've used our time. Our thanks to our guest, James Speth from Yale. He's dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and author of the book Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment, published by the Yale University Press. And Professor Speth, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.
I'll put in a good word with John Stewart for you.
Would you do that?
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll send him an email. Thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Just again, another reminder that our fiscal year here at WILL ends tomorrow, and we hope that we will have in the bank $800,000 to support the programming that you appreciate. That's for all of next year. And we are now, as of about 9 o'clock this morning, we were something like $44,000 short of that $800,000 total. You can make the difference by giving us a call right now, 217-244-9455, and making a pledge. Or you can go online, will.uiuc.edu. We're going to take a break. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the commodity markets.
And with this update on the markets coming up on 10:59, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. The wheat and corn futures on the Chicago Board of Trade holding about steady. The July wheat contract is down a half right now at 338, and September at 347 and three quarters, down a quarter. Corn for July down one and a quarter at 270. The September corn contract is down one at 274. December corn, 279 and a quarter, just changed to 279, and that's unchanged. And the March 05 corn is down one quarter right now at 285 and a quarter. Soybeans up. July, 895, up 10. August in fast trade, up